The Guardian.
Sunak freezes public sector pay as England prepares to leave lockdown for another tier system. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Our health emergency is not yet over, and our economic emergency has only just begun.
The Chancellor Rishi Sunak stood up in the House of Commons and announced his latest plans for tackling soaring unemployment and levelling up the UK. And, oh yes, to help pay for that, he's putting a freeze on the wages of some frontline workers and cutting overseas aid.
It is the season to be jolly, but it is also the season to be jolly careful.
While Sunak crunched the numbers, ministers from the four devolved nations came to an agreement on an easing of COVID restrictions for Christmas. Three households will be allowed to meet for up to 5 days in a Christmas bubble, or bauble, as Nicola Sturgeon called it. But is that the right thing to do? And what restrictions will we be put under until Christmas and afterwards? How will Johnson likely negotiate a new tier system with frustrated Tory MPs who are openly against more restrictions? And while the government wrestles with the COVID crisis, the Labour Party is wrestling with, well, itself. Yesterday, 13 left-wing members of Labour's governing body staged a mass walkout, or Zoom out, given it was all done online, in protest at the actions of the Labour leadership. NEC members such as former MP Laura Pidcock were angered at the election of Margaret Beckett, seen as a Keir Starmer ally, as the body's chair. This latest front in the long-running civil war had my colleague Peter Walker thinking, how have previous Labour leaders dealt with party infighting? We'll have more on that later on in the show. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, for anyone who didn't tune in to the Chancellor's spending review after Prime Minister's questions, I thought The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington could give us a run through most of the important points. Richard, thanks very much for coming on. We just watched Rishi Sunak present his spending review to the House of Commons. The overriding picture here is of a really grim economic outlook, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is probably the worst economic outlook that the UK has ever faced. It definitely is. We've had the worst downgrade in the public finances since the Office for Budget Responsibility was set up 10 years ago by George Osborne. The hit to the economy this year of about 11.3% is unprecedented. You have to go back to the 1700s, that's three centuries, to find a worse fall in gross domestic product. And the same story for the public finances too. £394 billion of borrowing by the government this year. That's more than double the amount that the UK borrowed during the 2008 financial crisis. So an absolutely unprecedented and grim picture for the UK this year.
And yet he didn't talk very much about how he's going to try and save money, did he? He talked more about the new spending that he's going to do, for example, on levelling up, this new levelling up fund.
Any local area will be able to bid directly to fund local projects.
Absolutely. I mean, the Chancellor wants to give, you know, a bit of encouragement, a bit of a positive story for the economy at this point of time, having been elected on a landslide in 2019 on a promise to level up the lopsided picture of the UK economy with huge imbalances between different regions. He really wanted to talk up that plan, that vision that the government has. £4 billion in new spending for that agenda, for levelling up, for local areas to spend on various projects if the local MP agrees. But no, given that scale of the hit to the public finances, one would expect there will be more to come next year, probably in the spring budget, setting out ways to find cost savings.
To protect jobs, pay rises in the rest of the public sector will be paused next year.
Richard, you've been reporting on the fact this public sector pay squeeze was coming. He tried to sweeten the pill a little bit, didn't he, for the lowest paid public sector workers?
The 2.1 million public sector workers who earn below the median wage of £24,000 will be guaranteed a pay rise of at least £250.
There was something in there that will give a little bit of comfort to public sector workers, to some of them. There will be a pay freeze for millions of other public sector workers that will be opposed tooth and nail by trade unions, I presume, over the coming weeks. For those on the lowest pay, there was also a bit there again from the Chancellor with a promise that those earning underneath £24,000 per year would get a pay rise worth £250.
I'm announcing today nearly £3 billion for my right honourable friend, the Work and Pension Secretary, to deliver a new three-year restart programme to help over a million people who've been unemployed for over a year find new work.
And there was an unemployment scheme too, or job creation scheme, wasn't there? Because, you know, looking at the Office for Budget Responsibilities charts, that the outlook for unemployment is really grim, isn't it? We haven't seen a fraction of what they're expecting in terms of the increase in unemployment.
Yes, it's 2.6 million people, 7.5% of the adult working population who would like to be working, by the middle of next year are going to be unemployed. Those figures don't quite surpass the 2008 financial crisis, which is one slim bit of comfort from the current crash. Given the scale of the hit to the economy, it might be a little bit surprising. But there has been an unprecedented amount of support pumped into protecting jobs from the government. The furlough scheme, particularly, now extended until the end of March, has helped to protect millions of workers' jobs. So perhaps that is one little ray of comfort. However, still 2.6 million people is a lot of people who are going to be out of work and looking for a job at a time when the jobs market is really disrupted by the pandemic, and will continue to be so for some time as the economy remains weak. So more support, more job creation measures were announced again by the Chancellor to tackle this issue.
I want to reassure the House that we will continue to protect the world's poorest. Spending the equivalent of 0.5% of our national income on overseas aid in 2021, allocating £10 billion at this spending review.
Richard, that controversial decision on aid, it will be opposed, as you say, by many Conservative MPs as well as by Labour. You know, Rishi Sunak said that was difficult to defend to the British people, didn't he? Will he be able to stick with that decision? It breaks a manifesto promise, doesn't it?
Breaks a manifesto promise. It breaks international commitments as well to the OECD, the group of wealthy nations, about 30 or so members around the world, including the US, France, Germany, Japan, countries that have all signed up to this commitment. However, the Chancellor was saying that reducing that amount during times of, you know, unprecedented stress for the public finances was the right thing to do. I'm sure that he will have many supporters on the Tory backbenches who have long called for the overseas aid budget to be reduced. But this is a controversial decision for him to take, and will be one to watch over the coming weeks and months about, you know, just how that plays out. That decision is going to continue to be the focus of political debate for some time.
Yeah, he's got a tricky few months ahead. And lastly, Richard, he barely mentioned Brexit, did he? Which is quite a big, you know, blip on the economic horizon, you might think. The OBR looked at it, didn't it?
It did indeed. So the effects to the economy next year, there will be a drag because of Britain leaving the EU. Deal or no deal, there is going to be a lower rate of growth as a consequence of the new trading relationships, which, having left the EU single market and customs union, will be less optimal for businesses than they are today. There will be more red tape. There will be greater disruption for companies trading overseas. And therefore, there is this slower rate of growth as a consequence. Chancellor maybe not wanted to talk about that because he's repeatedly said that Britain will prosper under any scenario. It's a bit of a conflict there with the Bank of England governor, who said this week that there will be undoubtedly costs for the economy over the long term from Britain leaving the EU.
Interesting. Richard, thank you ever so much. I know you've got a very busy day, so thanks for sharing a bit of time to run us through the main points. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
So I'm now going to turn to Guardian columnist Raphael Baer. Raphael, I wonder what you made of Rishi Sunak's delivery. As Richard was saying there, he was doing the sort of spending bit, the good news and not so much the bad news. There was lots of talk about, not quite we're all in this together, but of sort of, you know, everybody pulling together and making it a better place to live in and creating jobs. He has a very sort of a way of delivering sort of bad news, but it makes it sound rather sort of kind and, you know, almost as if you ought to be grateful.
Yes, the delivery method reminded me a little bit of the kind of aspiring family doctor. You know, there's this sort of unvarnished bit at the beginning where he just described the economic calamity and then started talking in terms of remedies. And there was an element of, you know, give it to me straight, Doc, how bad is it? Well, pretty bad, but here are the things we can do. My sense, my first sense at least, is he quite cleverly made sort of ongoing austerity sound like something else. You know, there's just not going to be that much money around, but he tried to make it sound as if, you know, the core public services were going to get their share, and public sector workers, that, you know, whom we have applauded, you know, on the medical front line, will get their pay rise, that sort of thing. So in the chamber afterwards, the trickiest bit has been all the noise around cutting the overseas aid budget, you know, and a lot of that coming from the Conservative side. So there's political sort of things going off that are going to cause him difficulty. But the broad presentation, I think, frankly, I think he did it quite well.
Aside from what, where money gets spent, Raf, and by whom, the other big decision that had to be made, particularly in Downing Street this week, was what happens to us all over Christmas, wasn't it? And indeed, what happens when the lockdown ends on December the 2nd? What did you make of this announcement that three families can meet for up to 5 days? It's, yet again, they're trying to sort of weigh the science and the scientific warnings, aren't they, with the hope of, you know, giving us all something to look forward to.
Yes, I find this whole thing very peculiar, actually, because when you sort of strip it down to its barest essentials, and this is going to sound very cold-hearted, what I'm about to say, but I'm just trying to understand what the calculation is actually going on. Because we don't really, you haven't completely suppressed the virus enough that you can just allow people to circulate and risk a high level of contagion, the calculation that's really going on here is, let's kind of everyone roll the dice a little bit over Christmas. That's going to result in some people getting very ill and some people dying, and we'll kind of know how many by maybe February or March. But if we sort of minimize that as best as we can, then no one's going to really know who rolled a one and who rolled a six, and we get Christmas, right? And it's a very odd political choice to be having to make. And in a way, that's the kind of calculation that's been going on throughout this process. You know, you could go full North Korea and shut everything down and no one would spread the virus, but then there would be other massive costs, obviously, as we know. So there are always these balancing acts. One sense is that ultimately Downing Street's judgment in this is steered quite heavily by the view on the, particularly on the Conservative benches in the House of Commons, and how much capacity Boris Johnson has to annoy those Tory MPs who really think that lockdown itself is just an aberration. Everyone should just be sort of running around buying as many things as possible, because he can't afford to make too many enemies, especially if he's got other things that might annoy them coming down the track, you know, a Brexit deal or tax rises or who knows what. So there are all these political calculations that don't really have that much to do with the risk of COVID infection, which are getting tangled up with quite a sort of a cold-blooded, rational calculation about how much risk you can allow.
And he is facing a potential rebellion, isn't he, over the tiered system that will replace the other tiered system, which was itself quite controversial, when lockdown ends, and then we'll come back into force after the sort of brief Christmas interlude. There's a lot of Tory MPs lobbying very hard, aren't there, to say, look, I don't like the look of this. I don't want my area to go into to face the highest restrictions, and, you know, look at the impact that would have on local businesses and so on. He could have to rely on Labour votes, couldn't he, to get that new system through Parliament?
Yes, I mean, when they were, you know, when the votes came sort of last time around to introduce the necessary regulations for the English national lockdown, and we should always make that distinction between the different nations of the UK, it became clear then that there were potentially enough Tory MPs to simply deprive him of a majority to implement the regulations. My sense on this is a little bit that the vaccine sort of coming down the track takes a bit of the sting out of this. I think the idea, the as it were, the sort of lockdown skeptic argument that, you know, just deal with it, suck it up, you know, and basically if you feel vulnerable, stay at home and everyone else get back to work, that's more important. I mean, that's a terrible caricature of their position. But there are some people who seem to believe that, and they are represented in the House of Commons. That position, I think, has been weakened a little bit by the fact that with a little bit of patience and enduring care and caution, we get to save lots of lives and then have a vaccine and then get a little bit back to normal. And I think that will probably make it a little bit less fraught next time we come to vote on, next time they come to vote on the regulations. But there'll still be lots of MPs causing Boris Johnson a lot of difficulty on this.
Raf, I should just ask you one final question about Brexit, where all these worries about Christmas and COVID and so on. But Boris Johnson has a very big decision to make, doesn't he? Potentially within days, or certainly within a week or two, about whether to go for a Brexit deal.
Yes, and that ultimately comes down to a political cost-benefit equation, which he has to resolve in terms of thinking, would he rather have the heroic moment of, behold, I have delivered the deal, I've met my promise, the manifesto is fulfilled, but then own quite a rubbishy outcome, it's not a great deal, and there's going to be some Tories and others complaining that it's a betrayal because there will be compromises in the deal. So that's one way of solving the equation. The other one is to think, no, maybe I'm better off saying, you know, gratifying the most hardcore portion of the audience and saying, no, the Brussels, they wanted to bind our hands. It can't be done. Sad to say, we're just going to have to go it alone, but it'll be worth it because liberation tastes delicious, where you get cheers from a different audience. But you take a really, really hard economic hit, very, you know, brutally upfront on the 1st of January. Now, my sense is that, you know, that there is a division more or less in Downing Street in terms of, you know, where he ought to land on that. Everyone sort of wants a deal, but the question is how expensive are the compromises in terms of how hard it will be to sell to the Conservative Party. My instinct is that what he wants is for people to just stop talking about Brexit now as soon as possible. He just wants, you know, Brexit, that was just someone that we used to know, job done. And in that case, you know, there are a lot of things pushing him towards a deal, but it's certainly not certain that that's where he'll get to.
And you didn't read the departure of Dominic Cummings and Lee Kane from Downing Street, known to be on the sort of more robust end of that. You didn't read that as a signal that, you know, perhaps he was willing to do a deal. Maybe it is. You'd think you'd want them by your side if you were going to be making that particular argument you talked about, didn't you, of you know, these intransigent Europeans, you know, refuse to let us get a deal.
Yes, although it's also been put to me that having Dominic Cummings out of Downing Street makes everything a bit harder, because any deal you do can then be kind of anathematized by the high priest of Brexit from the outside. You know, he wouldn't be invested in it at all. So, I mean, personally, I don't think Brexit was the thing that made it essential that Cummings and Kane go from Boris's point of view. There were other factors involved there. I do think it's part of a general shift in the kind of the mood and the culture, connected a little bit also to the Biden win in the US presidential election. That is, if Boris Johnson could choose, he would rather be a bit more of an establishment liberal Tory character, like the one he was when he was the mayor of London. Now, he's capable of being a break everything Trumpian maverick revolutionary figure. He's not afraid to do that kind of politics if he thinks it works. But all things being equal, he'd rather be sort of mayor of London Boris. And that person does the deal. So if he thinks he can get away with it and it's available, that's what he'd do. And the crucial person who's very much still in Downing Street and was on the sort of more hardline Cummings side of these things is David Frost, the chief negotiator. And he's still there, and he is a sovereignty fundamentalist and will really be telling Boris, you know, of the compromises in the deal, this doesn't deliver clean, proper Brexit. So it's still very much in the air.
Going to be fascinating in the next few days and weeks. Raphael Behr, thank you ever so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
After the break, Peter Walker takes a trip down memory lane to look at how previous Labour leaders have dealt with civil wars within the party. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, during what's a very difficult period for this Tory government, it might seem the ideal time for the Labour Party to capitalise on Conservative failings. Or it would be if the opposition wasn't so busy trying to get its own house in order. The suspension and reinstatement of Jeremy Corbyn to the party and Keir Starmer's subsequent decision not to restore the whip to the former leader has brought about a so-called civil war between the centre and the left of the party. This is not a new battle, but it's one that's reared its ugly head a number of times over the last several decades. So what lessons can the current leader learn from his predecessors, who oversaw previous instances of infighting? The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker put those questions and more to Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, Tim Bale. Peter was lucky enough to get into Parliament earlier in the week, so every now and then you might hear some background noise.
So, Polly and Tim, it's great you made it onto the show. We're here to talk about Labour splits in the Labour Party. And by coincidence, or perhaps not, about 20 minutes before this recording took place, there's a Labour National Executive kind of meeting taking place, and 13 members have walked out in protest at Keir Starmer's choice over who the NEC chair should be. Polly, this is something the Labour Party does quite well, isn't it?
Very good at it. Endless splits right from the very beginning. It really springs, and it's also true of the Tory party, they're just more disciplined about not actually splitting, but they've been deeply divided, wets and dries in Thatcher's day, and, you know, Brexiters and non-Brexiters, but they're just good at holding it together and more serious about power, I think, than Labour, who are more serious about ideology often, which is a mistake.
Tim, I mean, Keir Starmer obviously feels like he's got a very, very difficult task keeping this quite fractured party as one. But kind of cast your mind back, is this something that a lot of Labour leaders have faced over the decades?
Oh, yes. I mean, almost from the very beginning, Labour has had problems, I think, with holding itself together and with discipline. You only have to go back to the 1930s to see that Labour leaders have often fallen out very badly with their parties, to the extent that, of course, in the case of Ramsay MacDonald, he actually effectively left the Labour Party, or the Labour Party left him. And then if you fast forward into the 1950s, you have these very big bust-ups between the Bevanites and the Gaiskellites, the left wing and the right wing of the Labour Party. And naturally, that kind of discord pretty much rumbled on throughout the 1960s under Harold Wilson and then Jim Callaghan in the 1970s. And then, of course, it burst out really in the 1980s when we had Kinnock having to cope with the militant tendency. So it's a perennial feature, if you like, of Labour politics, as Polly suggests.
The kind of split to end them all, and certainly in the minds of many people who can still remember that far back, is 1981, with the Social Democratic Party split off. I guess we had something similar-ish last year when some Labour MPs broke off to form part of what was then Change UK. Polly, people who can't remember that far back, the SDP forming was a really, really big deal, wasn't it?
It was enormous. It was over 30 MPs, leading figures like Roy Jenkins, like Shirley Williams, like David Owen, and it really very nearly worked, but it didn't. In the end, our monstrous electoral system prevents any splits, and the pathetic little group who walked away just recently really hadn't learnt the lesson. You feel they were younger, but they hadn't looked at the history books. And if the SDP couldn't do it with that kind of heft behind it, at a time of, you know, extreme split in politics, where you had Thatcher at her most unpopular in 1981, and you had Foote at his most unpopular too, and this chasm in the middle, there should have been a space there for a left of centre moderate party. And if you can't do it then, I think it shows that our electoral system says, just don't try, forget about it. And our electoral system is to blame. We should, of course, have a left of Labour Socialist Party, and we should, of course, have a pro-European Tory party who then sit together in a coalition. It's appalling that they all are forced to cohabit like an unhappy couple still having to live under the same roof after a divorce.
Tim, so Michael Foote, who was a Labour leader at the time, he didn't last much longer. How much of that was due to the fact he couldn't keep the party as a kind of unit? And how much was it just fighting other factors, for example, Margaret Thatcher becoming more popular again? You know, how much did the splits actually damage Labour then?
Well, I mean, I think Michael Foote was always a controversial choice for leader, although he did play an important part in the governments of the 1970s. I think the electorate, and indeed many MPs, found it difficult to take him too seriously as the leader of the party. And that obviously undermined his authority. And then there was also the question of what some people considered his over-tolerant attitude to the left. I think Michael Foote was a product in some ways of the 1930s and even the idea of a kind of popular front, if you like, and believed that some aspects of the far left anyway could be useful, could be kept in the Labour Party. And I feel that many on the soft left in the end concluded that, you know, that was a bad idea and it simply allowed entryism. And then after he left, you have this really very, very big gap opening up between what I've already referred to, the soft left, represented by Neil Kinnock, if you like, and the left more generally. And it was really Kinnock's break with the left more generally and the ascension, if you like, of the soft left to power in the 1980s that made the real difference. Of course, people on the left will say there's no such thing as soft left. Kinnock et al. In the end became the kind of centre and right of the Labour Party and betrayed any kind of socialism as far as they were concerned.
And then when Neil Kinnock did take over as leader, I mean, the fight that he fought against what he saw as these kind of, I don't know, entrenched forces within the party was quite a brutal one. I mean, Polly ended up forcing out a reasonably large number of people. Looking back, I mean, did this kind of pave the way to Tony Blair and then Labour actually taking power?
I think it did. Labour was not going to be electable for as long as they were perceived to be riddled with militants. And, you know, the dramas in Liverpool that Neil Kinnock called out in that famous party conference speech.
Outdated, misplaced, irrelevant to the real needs. And you end in the grotesque chaos of a Labour council hiring taxis to scuttle around the city, handing out redundancy notices to its own workers.
Really were damaging to Labour, and he had to stand up to them. Labour would not have been electable for as long as Millicent was there. It was a kind of emotional purge. In the others just, I mean, I was living in Lambeth at the time, that Ted Knight, utterly infiltrated with and run by Millicent. They all sort of vanished after that. Power has its own momentum, to use a phrase, and Kinnock had it. And he didn't exactly drive them out by expelling people, but simply by showing the way forward.
Well, there was a famous Labour Party conference speech too, in which Neil Kinnock kind of completely castigated the left. Do you think that almost gave him some kind of, I don't know, moral force or something? It was a very, very passionate speech, and he very much made the case for what he was doing.
It was a brilliant speech, and it put it absolutely right about who Labour is there for, who it's there to protect, to defend, to stand up for, what Labour's ideas of social justice are. And there's no use having ideas about social justice if you're unelectable, if you reduce a great city like Liverpool to sending out redundancy notices by taxi to their own staff. It showed where extremism went. You have to play by the rules. If you want to govern, whether it's in a city or the country, you have to obey the law and play by the rules and win fair and square. And Kinnock was the John the Baptist who took Labour nearly back, but not quite.
I think it's worth saying, though, that, of course, Militant wasn't Kinnock's only problem, or perhaps even his main problem. The main problem for Neil Kinnock was actually the attachment of the party to various policies that the electorate regarded as anathema. You know, he had to get rid of unilateral nuclear disarmament. He had to ease up on the ideas of nationalisation, big public spending. You know, there was a lot of work to do to move Labour from the left to the centre. And even if Militant hadn't been around, that would have created all sorts of problems within the party for him.
Tim, one thing that might be puzzling a few people is that when Labour kind of moves more to the left, you sometimes get centrist MPs and others who break off from the party. But you don't really seem to get this whole group of, you know, when Labour moves towards the centre, you don't tend to get the left kind of splitting off. Is there a reason why that doesn't tend to take place?
Well, I mean, I think going back to the remarks Polly made about the electoral system, I think the left in general has got its head screwed on and realises that there's no possibility really of a serious party to the left of Labour under first past the post. It has to be said, though, although MPs have been notoriously reluctant to leave if they're left wingers, actually a lot of party members have left. And it was very noticeable, not so much under Neil Kinnock, but certainly under Tony Blair, that we did get a very big exodus from the Labour Party in terms of the grassroots, particularly, it has to be said, after Iraq. And in fact, many of those who came back into the party, either to support Jeremy Corbyn's candidacy for the leadership or to support him once he became leader, were actually what you might call retreads. In other words, you know, people from the left who'd left in the 1990s in disgust at what they saw as neoliberalism and warmongering, and who felt that they'd got their party back under Jeremy Corbyn.
One of the problems with all of that Labour grassroots stuff, and if you look at the grassroots website, is it's all about winning the Labour Party. It doesn't seem to have ambitions that go much beyond that. They feel they've won, and I always felt that Corbyn and those around him felt they'd won and were astonished that they had taken over the Labour Party. And that seemed to be the summit of their ambition. After that, actually winning power seemed to be secondary. And that's why the Tories are always in power, because they're serious about it. They mean it.
Yeah, I mean, see, I'm not entirely sure that that's the case. I mean, I think that people on the left have a different view of how to win power. They seem to be labouring under the idea that a large left-wing Labour Party will somehow be able to persuade the electorate that socialism is actually what they want, more or less gradually, and that that will eventually turn into votes for a Labour government. It also has to do with an idea of kind of grassroots activism, community organising, etc., where they feel they can kind of bypass what they regard as the mainstream media, which is, as they say, kind of misleading people, creating false consciousness. So I think they are interested in winning elections. They just think that there is a very different way of doing it, and one that hasn't proved particularly effective anyway in the UK in the decades that the Labour Party has been around.
In terms of the kind of broader difference between left-wing and right-wing parties, I mean, there's this idea the Conservative parties are more kind of pragmatic and tend to keep their splits within the party. Tim, is that a kind of thing that's reflected more broadly in left and right-wing parties, or is this quite a British thing, quite a Labour Tory thing?
I think it is reflected. I think the centre-right, if you look across Europe, has tended to hold together rather better. And I think that does have to do to some extent with what Polly's has already mentioned, that the left has a fondness for ideology, or at least explicit ideology, or at least institutionalizing or setting down that ideology, that far exceeds a similar enthusiasm on the right. That's not to say that centre-right parties aren't in the least bit ideological, but they're less concerned, if you like, with doctrine, and they're more prepared to kind of compromise, for the pursuit and for the sake of maintaining power. So I think largely that is the case right throughout Europe. It's not just Britain. And of course, you know, we do have to register an enormous caveat, particularly when it comes to the Conservative Party, because we mustn't run away with the idea that this is a party that somehow managed to avoid splits in recent years, because clearly that's not the case. And as we know, ever since really the late 1980s, Europe was the cause of massive discord within the Conservative Party. That looks to have been settled now, but only because, you know, one side is comprehensively lost and even been, if you like, evicted from the party. And the Eurosceptic side has won. But for a while, those two factions, if you like, were going at it hammer and tongs.
The Tory party has been taken over by Nigel Farage's Brexit party. It has become the Brexit party. And you look at the people that they've selected and the number of MPs who are pure Farageists in all their attitudes. And you see this is a party that has been transformed beyond any recognition. You know, it's the exact equivalent of a Corbyn or a match. It's much more extreme than Corbyn ever was, or indeed than Michael Foot ever was, in terms of the dramatic direction it's taken the country, as increasingly most voters now seem to be saying about regretting the Brexit vote.
And I guess the kind of other point to mention is that even now the Brexit wars within the Tory party are largely over. They have kind of new splits like this new COVID recovery group, which, you know, only the weekend was threatening Boris Johnson with 70 MPs voting against the COVID rules. So we're very much having Labour Party repeating, you know, what it's done in the past. We currently have, as I just mentioned at the start, we have 13 NEC members walking out of a meeting. If you were Keir Starmer, what kind of lessons from the past would you take? What's the best way to approach it? Do you need to be tough, or do you need to try to win people around?
I mean, I think the lesson from the past is that you do have to play hardball. There isn't much point in trying to compromise in the end, because these factions are very hard to compromise with as far as they're concerned. It's their way or the highway, which doesn't really leave you with a lot of choice. But having said that, of course, one of the things that I think Tony Blair and Neil Kinnock were able to do was to, if you like, strip off the soft left from the hard left and maintain the loyalty of the former. and get them tied into the project, giving them some sense that actually, if you are a left wing of the Labour Party, even if you've got a kind of centrist or a right wing leader, there's still a lot that they can do for you, particularly by getting you into government, that may well actually mean that you can win their loyalty and keep it. There will always be some people who you simply cannot compromise with, and you have to play tough with them.
Yep, that's absolutely right. To be a leader, to be seen as an electable leader, you have to be pretty tough. And that often means if your own side rebels, you have to be tough with them. Interestingly, Boris Johnson hasn't. He's caved in every time. And as a result, he's now regarded as somewhat weak. So Keir Starmer has no option but to be really tough with the left. The trouble is, on both sides, in all politics, there are some people who go into politics for a fight. And those people are wreckers, and they just have to be resisted.
I think what will be interesting to see will be to see how many members actually leave. If it looks as if Keir Starmer is, you know, playing hardball and the left aren't going to, you know, be able to get back in, I think that will be a measure of his success. I mean, right now, we know the Labour Party is, you know, it's around, say, 400 or 1,000 people, maybe towards 500,000. I mean, if that dips well below sort of 300,000, you will see actually that the left has been, if you like, defeated. But for many, even left-wing members of the Labour Party, you know, they've lost that many elections in a row now that they are prepared to compromise. So I don't necessarily think that we're going to see the mass exodus that some people predict.
But I guess the one thing you can be certain of is that in some form or another, the fights are going to carry on. Polly and Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all from us this week. For anyone wanting to hear more of the good news story on vaccines, The Guardian's health editor Sarah Bosley spoke all about it with Anushka Astana for Wednesday's episode of Today in Focus. Just search for it wherever you get your podcasts. Meanwhile, it only took 16 days, but Donald Trump finally showed the first tentative signs of concession this week when he gave the go-ahead for the Biden team to receive funding for a smooth transition to the White House. So now the Republicans have to take a good, hard look at themselves. What is the Republican Party without Trump? Listen to Friday's episode of Politics Weekly Extra when Jonathan Friedland and Professor Robert Reich discuss that very topic. But for now, I want to thank our guests Raphael Baer, Richard Partington, Polly Toynbee and Tim Bale. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.